You know what nobody tells you when you start planning your first real cross-country? That the flight itself is the easy part. The hard part is the night before, sitting at your kitchen table with a sectional chart, a plotter, and a blank nav log, wondering how all of this is supposed to come together. I'm Pattern on Traffic Pattern right here on Radio Hangar. And today, let's walk through this together column by column, because once you understand what a navigation log actually does, cross-country flying stops being intimidating and starts being fun. Before we dig in, a shout-out to our friends at AviationSoul.com. If you're about to fly your first cross-country, that's a milestone worth marking. AviationSoul makes challenge coins for every step of the journey. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all of it. Great way to celebrate the wins that got you here. AviationSoul.com. All right, the navigation log. Some people call it a nav log. Some call it a flight log. Your instructor might just call it the sheet. Whatever you call it, it's the backbone of every visual flight rules cross-country you'll ever fly. And here's the thing. The airman certification standards don't just want you to fill one out. The examiner is looking for you to understand why every number is there and to use it in the airplane. This isn't busy work. This is how you prove you can navigate. So let's say you're planning a flight. Pick something realistic. Maybe 130 nautical miles, two checkpoints between departure and destination, a nice day with winds out of the west at about 15 knots, nothing dramatic, just a normal training cross country. The first thing you do before you touch the nav log is draw your course line on the sectional. Pencil, straight edge, airport to airport. And this is where a lot of students rush. They draw the line and immediately start measuring, but stop. Look at what your line crosses. Does it go through any airspace you need to worry about? Any restricted areas? Any terrain that changes your minimum altitude? Any towers along the route? You are building situational awareness before you ever write a number down. That line on the chart is not just a direction, it's a commitment. Make sure you're comfortable with what it crosses. Now you pick your checkpoints. Your instructor probably told you to look for things that are easy to see from the air. And that's true. But let me add something. Pick checkpoints that are useful, not just visible. A highway intersection is visible, sure, but a checkpoint right before you'd need to change heading, or right where you'd want to check your time, that's useful. Space them out. Every 15 to 20 nautical miles is a good rule of thumb for your first few trips. Too many checkpoints and you'll spend the whole flight looking down at the log instead of outside. Too few and you won't catch a navigation error until you're way off course. Here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. Your first checkpoint should be close to the airport, maybe 8 to 10 miles out, because that first leg tells you everything. If your ground speed on leg 1 matches what you calculated, you know your wind correction is working. If it doesn't, you adjust early, instead of wondering why you're 5 miles off course an hour later. Okay, now the columns. And this is where students' eyes start to glaze over. So stay with me, because each one matters. Column 1, your checkpoint name. Write it clearly. You're going to be reading this in a bumpy cockpit with the sun in your eyes. Column 2, the course. This is your true course, measured from your departure point or from checkpoint to checkpoint with a plotter. Align the plotter with a line of longitude. Read the angle. Write it down. Most students get this right. Just double check that you're reading the correct end of the plotter. I've seen students plan a flight with a course that was 180 degrees backwards. They caught it on the ground, thankfully, but that's an easy mistake to avoid if you just take 2 seconds to sanity check the direction. Column 3. The distance for each leg. Measure it with the nautical mile scale on your plotter. Don't use the statute mile side by accident. That's a classic mistake that snowballs through every calculation that follows. Now here's where it gets interesting. Column 4 is your wind correction angle, and column 5 is your true heading. This is where the E6B flight computer earns its keep, and I know we covered the wind side of the E6B in a previous segment. If you haven't used it in a while, pull it out and practice, because this is exactly where you apply it. You set your true course, your wind direction, and your wind speed, and the computer gives you two things. Your ground speed and your wind correction angle. The wind correction angle is just the number of degrees you crab into the wind to hold your course. If the wind is from your left, you correct left. Simple. Add or subtract that from your true course, and you've got your true heading. Column 6. Magnetic variation. Look at the isogonic lines on your sectional. In the eastern United States, variation is west, so you add it. In the western states, it's east, so you subtract. East is least, west is best. That old memory trick actually works. Apply the variation to your true heading, and now you've got your magnetic heading. Column 7, compass deviation. This one's easy to forget because it's usually small. Look at the compass correction card in your airplane. It's that little placard near the magnetic compass. It tells you how many degrees the compass is off on various headings. Apply that correction, and you've got your compass heading, which is what you'd actually fly if you were using only the magnetic compass. In practice, you're probably flying a heading indicator, but the Navlog wants the full chain of corrections. True course to true heading to magnetic heading to compass heading. The examiner will ask you to explain each step, so know the logic, not just the numbers. Column 8, your ground speed. This came off the E6B when you solved for wind correction, and here's why it matters so much. Ground speed is what turns distance into time, and time is what turns fuel burn into a go or no-go decision. If you get ground speed wrong, everything downstream is wrong. Column 9. Estimated time en route for each leg. Distance divided by ground speed. If a leg is 30 nautical miles and your ground speed is 100 knots, that's 18 minutes. Write it down. When you're in the air, this is how you'll know if you're on plan. If your first checkpoint should appear in 12 minutes and it shows up in 16, your ground speed is slower than planned. Maybe the winds are different than forecast. That's information you can use. Column 10, your fuel burn for each leg. Take your fuel consumption rate from the pilot's operating handbook. Add your planned power setting and altitude. What does the airplane burn per hour? Divide by 60, multiply by the time for that leg, and you've got fuel in gallons. And here's a practical tip. Don't use the optimistic fuel burn numbers from the POH. Those are based on perfectly leaned engines at ideal conditions. Add 10 to 15% for real-world flying, especially if you're a student and you're probably running a little richer than textbook. Column 11, the cumulative fuel burn, just a running total, leg by leg, at any checkpoint, you should be able to glance at this column and know how much fuel you've used, which tells you how much you have left. That number needs to include your taxi and run-up fuel too. Most instructors suggest budgeting about a gallon and a half for taxi and run-up. Don't skip that, because on a shorter cross-country, that gallon and a half could be the difference between legal reserves and not. Which brings us to column 12, fuel remaining. Start with your total usable fuel. Not total fuel, usable fuel. There is a difference, and the POH will tell you exactly what it is. Subtract cumulative burn at each checkpoint. When you land, you need to have at least 30 minutes of fuel remaining for a daytime visual flight rules flight, 45 minutes at night. That's the legal minimum under Federal Aviation Regulation 91.151. But legal minimum is not safe minimum. I like to plan for at least an hour of reserve. The weather might be different than forecast. Your destination might have a traffic pattern full of airplanes and you're doing extra laps. You might need to divert. The extra fuel is cheap insurance. Column 13. Your altitude for each leg. Most cross-countries you'll fly a single altitude, but not always. Maybe there's rising terrain on the second leg and you need to step up. Maybe the winds at a different altitude are more favorable. And remember, the hemispherical cruising altitude rule under FAR 91.159 says that above 3,000 feet above the ground, if you're on a magnetic course of 0 through 179, you fly odd thousands plus 500, 180 through 359. Even thousands plus 500. So 3,500, 4,500, 5,500, and so on. Make sure your altitude matches your course direction. Now, you've filled out the nav log, all 13 columns. And this is the moment where a lot of students put down the pencil and think they're done. You're not done. There's one more step that separates a student who filled out a form from a pilot who planned a flight. Sanity, check the whole thing. Look at your total distance, total time, total fuel burn, and fuel remaining at destination. Does it make sense? If you're flying a Cessna 172 at 110 knots of true airspeed and your total distance is 130 miles, your flight should take somewhere around an hour and 15 minutes, give or take. If your nav log says 2 hours, something's wrong. If it says 45 minutes, something's wrong. Big errors are usually easy to catch if you just step back and look at the big picture. And here's something I really want you to take away from this. The nav log is not just a piece of paper you hand to the examiner. It's a tool. In the airplane, you're going to use it. When you pass each checkpoint, you write down your actual time. You compare it to your estimated time. If they match, you're on plan. If they don't, you know it now, not 30 miles later. You can adjust your heading, recalculate your fuel, and make better decisions because you built a plan that gives you something to measure against. On your check ride, the examiner is looking for a few specific things from the Airman Certification Standards. They want to see that you can plan and navigate across country using pilotage and dead reckoning. They want to see that you can identify and correct for wind drift. They want you to arrive at checkpoints within a reasonable time of your estimate, usually within 5 minutes. And they want to see that you monitor fuel and can state your fuel status at any point. Your nav log is how you demonstrate all of that. One more thing. Once you get comfortable with the nav log process on paper, it might take you 30 or 40 minutes to build one from scratch. That's normal. Don't rush it. Every minute you spend planning on the ground saves you 10 minutes of confusion in the air. And as you do more cross-countries, you'll get faster. You'll start to eyeball wind correction angles before you even touch the E6B. You'll know your airplane's fuel burn by heart. The process becomes second nature, and that's when cross-country flying goes from stressful to genuinely enjoyable. The navlog is just a structured way of answering the questions that every cross-country asks. Where am I going? How do I get there? How long will it take, and do I have enough fuel? Answer those honestly on paper before you start the engine, and you're already ahead of most of the problems that catch pilots off guard. This segment leaned heavily on the FAA Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, chapters 15 and 16, and the Airman Certification Standards for Private Pilot, both free from the FAA, both worth rereading before your check ride. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Pattern. Go build that nav log. And when you nail your first checkpoint right on time, you'll know exactly why it felt so good. See you next time.